Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today is associate editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Adam's a little sick right now. Apparently everyone got sick after Sundance, which is surprising. The weather was nice. It's not like we were all enduring a snowstorm or harsh weather, but apparently it's something going around, so if you'll bear...
People.
I'm sure everyone was very hygienic.
People in airports. It was Utah. I blame Utah.
I blame Utah. I blame Utah for many things in the world, so why stop there? So just if Adam is coughing and wheezing, please don't be upset, but give him your well wishes, is what we're saying. But we're going to be talking about this year's Sundance and our feelings on it. And also, this was Adam's second Sundance, but it's his first Sundance since having gone to TIFF. And they're two very different festivals. And so for those who don't really understand Sundance, Sundance is really a festival that came to prominence in the late 80s, early 90s, when kind of Miramax moved in and discovered that there was this wealth of talent that they could sort of buy cheaply and then expand into hits. But it was also a place where these auteurs could really be discovered and expand and have these breakout independent films. So you have films like Reservoir Dogs and Hard Eight, although Hard Eight was in the later half of the 90s. Clerks was in there. Hoop Dreams was in there. So these films that really helped directors who may not have had the attention that they should have had. So I think we owe a debt to Sundance. However, the flip side of it is that, of course, once Miramax found a recipe for success, all these other studios moved in and started clawing and trying to get their hands on what they felt would be a big hit. And ironically is that this was, like any boom, there followed a bust. And so, for instance, Warner Independent Pictures is dead. Paramount Vantage is dead. And then other studios sort of shifted their focus a little bit to sort of not become Sundance exclusive. So there are still studios with their indie arms. So, for instance, Fox still has Fox Searchlight. So some did survive. But the festival, I feel, itself changed because the real sense of an independent film, a guy coming out of nowhere, maybe with a star or two that you've heard of, but no one who is even close to resembling an A-lister, would come in. So you could have Quentin Tarantino with the Reservoir Dogs come in there, and it's like, yeah, you've seen Harvey Keitel, and you've seen Steve Buscemi, you know some of the cast, but it really blows up in a big way. And now Sundance has the premieres category, where you can have films starring Sam Rockwell and Keira Knightley, or last year it was The Way, Way Back, starring Steve Carell. And so those are much easier sells to the populace, and we only call them independents because they just cost much less than studio films. You're not going to find a lot in between in that $40 million range, because the stars work for scale on the indies, and they take that lower end. And then on the blockbuster side is just, it has to be at least over $100 million. So, sadly, it's hard to find those films in between. But Sundance has gems all its own, and it still helps bring directors to attention, assuming they can seize on it. So, again, I'm not sure if it was last year or the year before, but there was a film called Safety Not Guaranteed, which was directed by Colin Trevorrow, who was very savvy and managed to turn the success of that small film into directing the fourth Jurassic Park movie. So it's that kind of segue that it allows people. So career-wise, it can help people. But as for the films themselves, it's a variety, like you'll find anywhere else. You have some great ones, and you have some really shitty ones, and some ones that are kind of okay. It just runs the gamut, and you just hope that you find the good ones, because it really is kind of luck of the draw. Now, obviously, there are going to be some must-see films, so going into this one, my must-see was The Raid 2 and Boyhood. And boy, did we suffer for Boyhood, Adam and I. There was a bit of a mix-up in ticketing this year that made life so much more difficult for everybody. But briefly, We woke up very early to get Boyhood tickets in person, but because we had requested online tickets as backups for another screening, they said, you're going to get the backups. And at no point did we know that would supersede the ones we woke up at 6:30. We woke up at 5:30 in the morning. It was 5:30 or 6, walked to the press office, made sure we were first in line for tickets that we did not get. That was a fun day. But we did get to see Boyhood, and we loved Boyhood, and we loved other films. And I've been talking for about 5 minutes straight. So I'm going to hand it over to Adam to, let's just see, you know, what did you like this year? What didn't you like?
It was a good year overall. Like Matt said, it's kind of a, you're just kind of rolling the dice on a lot of this stuff, because the thing about Sundance is that you go in and no one has seen any of these movies. There's no buzz. There's nothing. It's just you see a movie title, the director, the cast, and a short one-line synopsis. So that's all you have to go off of. So you're just kind of picking, you know, kind of what might fit in your schedule, what sounds interesting, what sounds cool. And I did pretty well with my picks this year. A lot of times it can also depend on you. Like Matt and I saw some different movies where we kind of split, and he chose these and I chose the other ones, and I ended up doing better. So, you know, rub that in Matt's face. But I really liked, I guess the biggest surprise for me, and probably my favorite film of the festival this year, was I Origins by Mike Cahill, written and directed by Mike Cahill. He wrote and directed Another Earth. And I Origins is this kind of really ambitious science versus faith drama, really emotional, really powerful. Michael Pitt leads the cast, Britt Marling's in it, Stephen Yeun, and Astrid Burgess Berkeley, I think is her name. But that one was one that, you know, I just, it sounded interesting. I like science. It's about a scientist kind of studying the human eyeball and stumbles upon a discovery that has major repercussions. And I was like, that sounds interesting, and went to the premiere, and I loved that one. Really enjoyed The Skeleton Twins. It was a drama starring Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig as suicidal siblings, is kind of the one-liner for that one. A lot funnier than I thought it was going to be, but Bill Hader did a fantastic dramatic turn in that one. And then on the documentary side of things, I really, really enjoyed The Internet's Own Boy, about Aaron Schwartz, the co-founder of Reddit and political activist who committed suicide at 26. So those were kind of the highlights for me, in addition to Boyhood, Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which was absolutely fascinating and magnificent. So, oh, and then another one that I just completely randomly chose, The Voices with Ryan Reynolds, is an insane movie about a guy who talks to his pets, and I did not know what I was getting into, but it's...
And his pets talk back to him.
And his pets talk back to him, and it's fantastic and ridiculous, and I have no idea how whatever studio picks it up is going to sell it. I think it will probably do better on VOD, but that one it's an insane movie that proves that Ryan Reynolds can definitely act, and it's funny and weird and strange, and that was a surprise to me as well, because I did not know what I was expecting.
Yeah, no, I did strike out on some of these. The biggest one I struck out on was a film that everybody else apparently loved, which was Love is Strange, starring Alfred Molina and John Lithgow, and I just thought it was fucking terrible. Its central thesis made no sense, which is you have these two, you have a gay couple, and they love each other. They've been together for 39 years. They've just gotten married now that marriage is legal in New York. But because Alfred Molina's character works at a Catholic school as the choir director, and it was okay when he was openly gay, but now that he's married, he's upset the archdiocese, which means he's been fired, which means they can't afford their nice New York apartment. At which point, instead of their love basically saying, okay, we're going to go to Poughkeepsie for a while, and yes, it's far away, but we'll make the drive, we'll learn how to drive, we're going to make the drive, and we'll do apartment hunting, and we'll make a concerted effort. They'll be like, no, let's just stay with separate people because we don't want to be inconvenienced. It's like, wow, your love story is really moving. And the problem is that the film's greatest strength is that Molina and Lithgow are so great together on screen together, so you really buy their love, which makes the film make even less sense that they'd be willing to be apart from each other. So I just don't know what other people saw in it, but I'm happy they liked it. But when I was that one really put me in a sour mood, because just as I was getting seated for Love is Strange, Adam, I think, was getting seated for I, Origins, and we come out of the theaters. He has one that he loves. I have one that was by far the worst I saw at the festival. Well, not by far, because not following too far behind was John Slattery's feature debut, God's Pocket, which we all couldn't stop saying is God's Pocket. And it's bad, too. It's like a film that's trying to be a showcase for its actors, and in a way it is, but it has no story, and it's just very scattershot, and
it's very weird too.
It's very weird, and it's
not good.
It's kind of grimy and dirty, but not in a dramatic way. It's just this filthy little shit town where you don't want to be with these people, and at times it's dramatic, and then at times it's darkly comic, but neither one really it works. So those I would say were the two best. I would say that Laggies was disappointing. Yeah, the two. Did I say the two best?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Two best at being worst. Boom. Nailed it. So I would say that then Laggies and Kimiko the Treasure Hunter were disappointing. They weren't awful. And then, yeah, there were a lot of good ones. I really liked The Guest. I liked... the ones I loved were Boyhood, Calvary, and The Raid 2. And so I'm looking forward to seeing those again. And we should just make a brief note that we're recommending these films. Titles change.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's
a
little.
A lot of these titles are going to change. Laggies will change. I bet I, Origins will change.
Oh, I, Origins has to change. there's a film that a lot of people really liked called Infinitely Polar Bear. And that one's probably going to change. So, yeah, we're telling you these now. And when we keep reporting them on the site, we'll be sure to mention their older title so that you're not completely lost here in terms of what we liked and disliked.
Yeah, God's Pocket was really the only major strikeout for me. I didn't love Laggies, but it was, the cast was charming, but the plot made no sense. My biggest disappointment, though, was Wish I Was Here, Zach Braff's movie, which I loved Garden State. I haven't seen it in a while, but I'm not one of those people that's going to jump on the bandwagon and say, oh, fuck Garden State just because I'm older.
Come on to the bandwagon, Adam. It's so comfortable here. We love it.
I genuinely enjoy Garden State. I was really looking forward to this one, and it just did not come together for me. The whole point that Zach Braff went on Kickstarter was because he wanted to make this film, but he didn't want to have studio notes and, you know, other people. He wanted to make it creatively uncompromised, and I think that's probably the main issue with it, is that there's stuff that works really well, but the stuff that doesn't work really, really doesn't work and takes you completely out of the movie. There's a subplot involving Comic-Con, which is really weird. It involves like Josh Gad's character. But I mean, surprisingly, the best part about that movie by far is Kate Hudson, who gives a really strong performance and a really good character that Braff has written. So that one was kind of a mixed bag, and one that I was really looking forward to, but was kind of, I guess, my biggest disappointment. Did you have any big disappointments, Matt?
I mean, really, for me, the biggest one is Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, because I think it has a really interesting story, mm-hmm. which is that, and this is based on a true story, which is that, unlike Fargo, which says it's based on a true story, there's a woman named Kimiko, who's played by Rinko Kikuchi. She sees Fargo, and it gets off to a really weird start, because she finds a VHS tape of Fargo buried in a cave, and we don't know how she got to that cave. That's how the film opens. Pops this damaged tape in and believes that when Steve Buscemi's character buries this satchel full of money, that it's real, and that satchel of money is really there, and that she doesn't even need the money. She just wants to find it because her life in Japan is so shitty, where people either want her or expect her to either be like a cutthroat businesswoman who is only focused on her career, or she has to settle down and become a wife and mother. Those are her only two options. But the character is just so detached and antisocial that you don't really get anything from her. She's almost an enigma, and it sort of lessens the power of her quest. And I still think it has some interesting things to say about the nature of truth as conveyed by films, because obviously, this is a true story about Kimiko, it's not 100% true. No film is 100% true. Even documentaries, while they have to be factual, it's still a point of view. They can't cover everything from every angle. So there's always that misleading aspect of it, just like Kimiko is misled into believing this treasure is real. So it's an interesting film, but it's not an emotionally involving one, and that's why I found it disappointing. In addition to the fact that it has a really good story.
Yeah,
so that would
that's one that I thought was interesting and that I missed. And another thing about Sundance is that you can't see everything, especially when we were only there for 7 days this year instead of 10 days last year. So there were a lot of movies that sounded really interesting or that got really positive response that we didn't catch, like Infinitely Polar Bear. I was really looking forward to a movie called The One I Love, written by the author of Dear Girls Above Me, starring Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, and I didn't get to see it, and the response to that was through the roof. Apparently it's very, very different from what the synopsis says. So there were a lot of films on there, and I still want to see Love is Strange to see if it's as terrible as Matt says, because
you're gonna love it. I'm gonna be in the minority on that one. Exactly. I'm gonna be in the minority on that one. I'm just gonna accept it.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I wanted to catch, but couldn't.
Right. But interestingly, even though The One I Love was through the roof, I still don't think it was as unanimous, because first off, by the time it played, a lot of people had left. So it didn't have that early fire that you and I talked about, where this year there was no breakthrough film that came out of nowhere. There was no Beasts of the Southern Wild. There was no Fruitvale. At the time, it was just called Fruitvale. There was no that film did not happen this year.
Or Like now, there Crazy. Were... And I was trying to think of... I was looking down the schedule and trying to think of a breakout hit or something like that, but... What Beasts and Fruitvale and Like Crazy and all those things have in common as a quote-unquote breakout, what signifies them as a breakout is that they're from an unknown director at the time. Nobody knew who Ben Zeitlin was when he directed Beasts of the Southern Wild. Nobody knew Ryan Coogler. That was his first feature when he made Fruitvale. Like Crazy, Drake Doremus, that was his first movie. And so these were movies that...
And they don't have big name stars. Like,
yeah.
Obviously, like Octavia Spencer's the biggest star in Fruitvale. And even then, she's a supporting role. And Michael B. Jordan, like, if you know The Wire and Friday Night Lights, yeah, you know him. But he is not, like, a guy that a lot of people knew. And his performance blew people away.
Yeah.
No one knew anyone in Beasts of the Southern Wild.
No.
Not a soul. And so, yeah, it flies on the radar because you just don't know who's behind it.
And we just didn't have one of those this year. It was a weird year. You couldn't find a consensus on anything. Like, I Origins had a really strong response from its premiere screening, but you could still find people who didn't care for it. Same with Boyhood. There were people who thought it was a masterpiece and other people who thought it was, you know, enjoyable, but maybe just a gimmick. And those don't even qualify as quote-unquote breakout hits because, you know, Mike Cahill was already here for Another Earth, and
Linklater is
Linklater. So it
was
a weird thing.
Yeah, if there is a breakout, and it's the one that won the Sundance Awards last night, was Damien Chazelle's Whiplash, because no one knew that's his first feature. It's an adapt. He based it off the short film he did of the same name, and we saw that the first night that was our very first Sundance film this year, and people loved it, but it didn't blow me away. I think it has problems finding an ending.
Yeah, and I talked to a lot of people who felt the same way. And what's strange about it is Whiplash won both the U.S. Grand Jury Prize for the U.S. Dramatic Competition and also the Audience Award, which is kind of like a two-peat. The Audience Award, obviously, the audience votes on it, and then the Grand Jury Prize, the jury who's voting for the Dramatic Competition films votes on that. And it's a weird movie to do that because all of the other past films that have done that are Fruitvale, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Precious, all these movies that have like really kind of emotionally impactful stories, and I don't know anyone who is kind of like emotionally wrapped up in Whiplash.
No, I mean it's a horror film.
It's a horror slash thriller.
It's a horror
film. It's entertaining. It's fun. There could be some tweaking to make it better. I mean, I enjoyed it, but
it's not my tempo. But...
not my tempo. That is a joke that only people who have seen Whiplash will get. And
I know, right?
J.K. Simmons is fantastic in it. Taylor made for him, but I just thought it was strange that it won both of those awards, and it's not an emotional movie, it's not really an Oscar movie. I could see J.K. Simmons getting a nomination maybe, but
in a very sparse year,
yes, but yeah, I just thought that was strange. I mean, I'm not knocking the film, I enjoyed it, and I thought it was a strong debut, but it's not one of these big emotionally resonant.
Yeah, it's not gonna stay with you for the most part. It doesn't have that emotion. It doesn't get its emotional hooks into you. It's just a well-made thriller slash horror film that you wouldn't normally think of as that kind of movie. Because plot-wise, it's just about a guy who's really throwing himself into playing the drums, but the demands of him just sort of wreck his psyche. So it's a good film, but yeah, it was a film that when it won those awards, I'm like, okay. And then I started thinking about how the festival still kind of favors films that play earlier. So, you know, you're saying like The One I Love got a lot of great buzz, but it was so late in the festival that, you know, if you're having an audience award, you know, and most of your audience has left, well, then your numbers game is completely fucked.
Sure.
So there's that problem as well. So it's not like Sundance is the end-all, be-all, but I do, of the festivals I go to, I like Sundance the best for... This year was underwhelming, and for the reasons Adam stated, it was... we weren't there as long. I would say that the press office was really not at the top of their game. Usually they handle things pretty well. This year they were kind of a mess. There were people there that I like to see that weren't there, and there was a lack of a breakout film. That all being said, I still love the atmosphere of it. It has a personality in the cold weather. You all bundle up, and this small town of Park City transforms itself to accommodate tens of thousands of people who just kind of flood in for this one festival. And all the volunteers are super friendly and nice and knowledgeable. And again, you will find films that are, some are genuine indies, and then others are sort of the faux indies that have big stars who are just working for scale. And if you go up the road to Slam Dance, which I've never been to, that's the real indie festival. And this year they actually honored Christopher Nolan because his debut feature, Following, which holds up, by the way, Following is still fantastic. It's in the Criterion Collection now. That played at Slam Dance. Lena Dunham had a short film that played at Slam Dance. If you want to maybe find out who could be the next big person, you want to maybe check out Slam Dance. And I'm sorry I've never been, but that's the true indie festival. But that's just to give you an idea of how big it is. That Sundance is so big, it has a little indie fest. Like, they're not, they don't have like a corporate relationship or anything like that. It just sort of built on the name. And the two are just connected. So that's how big Sundance is. And then the other festival I've been to, South by Southwest is good in terms of their programming committee, but it's horribly run. Nothing starts on time. Fantastic Fest is awesome, but it's for a very niche group. If you go to Fantastic Fest, probably at least half the films you see will never get distribution. So it's kind of hard to champion stuff like you want to, and there's still great things there. And Cheap Thrills, which was kind of the breakout film of Fantastic Fest, that now has my attention, and there's a trailer out, and it looks really fun. So Fantastic Fest isn't bad, but it's very, very genre niche specific, which is still great, but it's not as something where, like Sundance, where I can say, keep an eye out for this. And then there's TIFF, which is, you can find stuff that you wouldn't normally see, but it's really the start of an awards engine. And so, Adam, back to you. Last year was the first time you'd been to TIFF. So now having gone to TIFF and going back to Sundance, what are your thoughts on both? How they relate to each other?
Well, first off, I would say that just comparing this Sundance to last Sundance, I think this year I had a better run of movies, even though the atmosphere was a little weird and it all kind of felt a little weird. I think I found more movies that I will love or more variety, because, I mean, you had The Guest from the guys behind your necks, which is like a mashup of Halloween and The Terminator and The Boyhood and a bunch of different stuff. But comparing this to TIFF, they're both very different festivals. And I think I enjoy Sundance more because going into TIFF, you know kind of what you're getting into. When we were going to TIFF last year, the lineup was Gravity, 12 Years a Slave, a bunch of movies that are getting ready to kick off their award season. And, I mean, if you look at this year's award season or award seasons past, the Best Picture frontrunners almost always have played at TIFF. I think they're going on like a 6 or 8 year streak now of the Best Picture winner having played at the Toronto Film Festival. So TIFF is where studios are wanting to, you know, kick off their awards campaign and get that stuff going. So you're having the premieres of a bunch of really highly anticipated movies at TIFF.
Or the real premieres. Most of these films are now playing at Telluride, but that's like a pre-buzz thing because Telluride's so expensive.
And it's like a week before TIFF, so it's not exactly that long to wait.
So technically not the premieres, but you're right. TIFF is really where it begins.
Yeah, and there are some discoveries to be made at TIFF. I saw a movie at TIFF last year called The F Word from director Michael Dowse, who directed
Goon.
What's it called?
He directed Goon.
Goon, yeah, Goon. I think The F Word's title is being changed, but it was a discovery. It was a movie I really enjoyed, but I mean, it starred Daniel Radcliffe and Adam Driver and Zoe Kazan, so it starred people I knew, and I kind of knew what I was getting into, but I really, really enjoyed it. So the discoveries at TIFF are not so much discoveries in that, wow, I didn't know this film existed, and are instead kind of like, oh, wow, that was a lot different or better than I expected, as opposed to Sundance, you know, you're going and you have no idea. Because at TIFF, again, as Matt said, a lot of these films have played at Telluride a week before, so you're starting to hear like the very beginnings of buzz.
Yeah, or you've seen the trailer, for God's sakes.
Yes,
like Gravity and 12 Years a Slave. We saw those trailers, and they looked great.
Osage County, that played there as well. I mean, you're going in, and your perception of these movies is colored. And I guess, and me being based in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I'm hearing response to like almost every weekend's new movie before I'm seeing it. So Sundance is neat for me because I get to see movies in a vacuum. I get to see them without hearing everyone.
Yeah, that's another great thing about Sundance. It's very hard to know what you're getting, and that's what makes it exciting, because I didn't know anything about iOrigins. You didn't know anything about iOrigins. You know who Michael Pitt and Britt Marling are and Steven Yeun, but other than that, what did you know, really?
You're literally rolling the dice. You're like, this could be good, this could be very bad. I mean, I went to the world premiere of Two Mothers last year, which was, I think it's now called A Door. It's the one with Robin Wright and...
Naomi Watts,
and they fall in love with each other's son. So that was a premiere experience of you know.
What was the first Sundance movie you called? Was it May in the Summer? Was that it?
May in the Summer.
And it still hasn't been released.
Well, but my point was that at Sundance premieres, it's not all, you know, cheery and yay, good for that film. At the premiere of Two Mothers, there was a lot of uncomfortable laughter and a lot of walkouts, and it was a very awkward Q&A afterwards with the director who wasn't necessarily expecting laughs during that. And then you go to a movie like iOrigins, or I still remember last year we were at the world premiere of Before Midnight, and you know, the crowd just goes nuts afterwards because it's so good and everyone's, you know, so wrapped up in it. So,
and then there are times like The Way, Way Back where it gets a standing ovation and I'm sitting there going, what the fuck, really, people? Yeah. Are you serious?
That's how everyone was after that movie.
Except all the people standing and clapping.
Sure.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. I also think Sundance does, at its premieres, does bring in a little bit more... It's just pumped up, so where films with standing ovations, maybe it's inflated. Now, that's not to say it's always the case, but...
Absolutely. I mean, when Whiplash was the first movie of opening night, and traditionally opening night Sundance films aren't the best. They're movies that are kind of okay. And this year the director, his response to why he programmed Whiplash on opening night when it's traditionally saved for okay movies, he said he was tired of hearing about it. So I think that caught everyone by surprise that it was actually a good movie, that I think everyone just blew their load, like went crazy, because people were like, I caught the hyperbole right afterwards, because I was like, that was good, and everyone was like, oh my god, Whiplash is amazing, and I was like, calm down.
And see, actually I'm really glad that our press screening was at the same time, because at Sundance it can be timed where the premiere screening, and in fact it usually falls this way, is that the premiere screening is before the press screening. And so the premiere screening response kind of starts steering how you're going to the press screenings. Because if you hear something really bad, it's like, well, what else is playing at that time? Because now or if it's really good, it's like, oh shit, I gotta find a way to rearrange my schedule. So a couple of years ago when Beast of the Southern Wild played at its premiere, and you're looking on Twitter and everyone's just blowing up, and you're like, oh shit, well, I'm okay, I'll go to the press screening. And then you go to the press screening, and it's like, oh shit, it's amazing. So that's one of the things. I'm usually not one of those people that tweets their thoughts on movies after I see them, but I'll do it at festivals, because festivals are kind of, that's the new conversation, that's the fastest social media thing. And if you want to steer people to the films you liked or away from the films you didn't like, then yeah, you just go on and you give your brief thoughts. And then obviously Adam and I reviewed every movie we saw. Mm-hmm. So that was still there for people who wanted it. we just didn't do like a pithy little brr, this sucked, this skirt, brr, you know, we didn't do that.
That's
there
were
some
thing,
people who did, but not us.
Yeah, that's it's a weird atmosphere because a lot of these movies that you're seeing are, you know, a lot of the movies that get into Sundance have been independently financed, but they don't have distribution. So literally everything that you're saying on Twitter or in your review is being used to either sell or not sell this movie. So we have to kind of be mindful of the fact that, you know, what we're saying has an impact on some of these unsold movies, on what's going to happen to them in the future. So if I'm just kind of okay on a movie, I don't feel the need to tweet its shortcomings immediately afterwards.
I mean, I just want to, like, I'm not one of those people who will be like, I'm going to give this 30 seconds of thought. I'm going to give this as much thought as it takes me to get to Twitter. I will give it a few minutes at least. Because there are people who are like, the second that film ends, the phone comes on, the Twitter, they go to Twitter, and it's just like, boom, snap reaction.
They've been composing their tweet in their head for the last 30 minutes of the film.
Exactly. It's like, man, how can I get this down in 140 characters or less? And that's frustrating. But again, on the one hand, you know, you're just trying to rally support for things. And I understand completely where Adam's coming from, where you don't want to, like, hurt films that you didn't feel great about, like, you don't want to. But for me, we're all playing, when you come to Sundance, you're playing pro ball. Like, if you were at Slam Dance, then, and I don't like your film, I'm going to shut my mouth about it, because that's true indie. That's your, I mean, that's really tough. You have no stars in your film. And because even when you're playing a star for scale, that ain't cheap. Like, that would cost, like someone who is really struggling, that's probably not a possibility for them. So when you go into Sundance and you're playing at that level, I feel that the only way to be fair is to say what I honestly thought of your film.
Sure,
because
I was just saying, if
you're
I'm
putting
not
yourself out there.
I was just saying, if I'm not reviewing it, I don't feel the need to go on Twitter and bash it. Like, if I'm reviewing it, obviously I'm going to say what I think in my review, but...
Okay, yeah, that's fair. I'm not saying, why didn't you hate more things? I just
I picked good movies, damn it.
You did. You really did. And although that being said, had we stayed there for longer, who knows how that batting average would have gone.
Yeah, that's true. It kind of starts to thin out, and you're kind of just picking stuff that's going to fit into your schedule that way.
Yeah, although I would have been... I know for me, it would have been very different as well, because your schedule was based on things I couldn't see. So, for instance, had we been there longer, I would have made it a point to see The Voices, because I really wanted to see The Voices.
Sure.
And which means you probably, either you might have gone, but you wouldn't have reviewed it. So we were just trying to, like, make sure we covered as
many
things as possible.
Maybe if I saw it first, I'd review it.
Indeed. Well, see, that's the thing, though, because if you saw it, then I'm pretty sure it would have been like, no, we have to see as many movies as possible, and I'm going to a movie, and I'm just going to sit there and take it in and not have to write the review. And while that's fantastic, I'm pretty sure my prerogative would have to remain, what haven't we seen yet?
Sure.
We did have to keep our mouths shut the entire time we were there, because we had a screener of They Came Together, which is how I had my review. For people, like, I'm sure there are some people, it's like, didn't you leave Sundance? Why do you have a They Came Together review on the site after the film had played? It's like, well, that's how I saw it. I didn't just make up a review on the fly. It's like, you know what? This is how I think this movie is going to be. I'm just going to make up a review out of whole cloth. It was a good movie, though. And it's one of those things where although they played it so late in the festival, like we weren't the only ones who had left by then. There were other major sites that had been like, we can't stay that long. So it had really thinned out by that point. The film's going to get released in June, and it's really funny, and you should absolutely see it, especially if you're a fan of Wet Hot American Summer, which is David Wayne's earlier film. And while he's done Wanderlust and
Role Models,
like more conventional mainstream films, They Came Together is way more in the Wet Hot American Summer weird spoof kind of movie.
It's very out there, but it's hilarious. It's absurd humor. If you're one of the people that enjoyed the Ron Burgundy Goes Blind plot of Anchorman 2, you will enjoy They Came Together.
I'm blind. There was a film called Blind at Sundance, and every time I heard the title, I was like, I'm blind. So that and God's Pocket were two titles I couldn't help but make fun of. But, oh, another fun title to say, The Babadook. It is really fun to say The Babadook, which I thought was a comedy going into it because it's a funny title. It is a fucking scary movie. It is a straight up... This is what we're talking about, because I didn't even read the synopsis. If I don't have to read the synopsis, I won't, because that's how cold I want to go into these movies. And The Babadook made me rethink that a bit, rethink that policy, because, oh my goodness, it was really just getting to me. But that's the thing. That film has no stars in it. It has a weird title. Didn't know anything about it. It scared the shit out of me, and it's a really good film. That's the fun of Sundance. And I'm thinking back to TIFF, and the only film I can think of that I, off the top of my head, that I didn't know anything about was called The Missing Picture, which is this really, I don't even know how to describe it. It's this guy, and he grew up during a genocide, and people he loved died, and friends and family died. And I think it was during the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. But he tells the story with clay figures and narration. And it's a film, it's like, I can't give this a review, because I can't give your suffering a B+. Like, I can't, dude, this is too, like, you lived through this shit. Like, it's not like The Act of Killing, which is, you know, disturbing, but Joshua Oppenheimer sort of coming to it as sort of an outsider to sort of break things down. It's not from a personal perspective in the sense that, like, his friends and family died. But it's a really affecting picture. But the only reason I saw The Missing Picture was because they had moved the screening of The Fifth Estate. Had The Fifth Estate stayed at its time slot, I would have seen that instead of The Missing Picture. That's how it's actually harder at TIFF to see the smaller stuff when you're covering TIFF, because for us, we have to cover the big films, because that's what our readers want.
Yeah,
they want to know.
You're seeing the premiere of Prisoners, The Fifth Estate, Labor Day, 12 Years a Slave, Dallas Buyers Club, Enough Said, Gravity, August Osage County, all of those movies were at TIFF. So it's just, I mean, your schedule is packed with, number one, movies that you know a lot about or have heard things about, and then number two, movies that are, you know, world premieres or first time they're screening.
Right, it's really just the dictates of the festival, and that's sort of the double-edged sword. We can get press badges, and that lets us in and gives us variety, but someone who buys their ticket, they're probably going to want to see the big stuff too, but they have the leeway to sort of change it up and maybe see smaller stuff. But TIFF doesn't really have as much smaller stuff as Sundance. Sundance is where the small stuff is. Fantastic Fest is where the really small stuff is. Atlanta Film Festival is where almost nothing is. I kid because I love, but not really. They could really use some more money. And if you're listening to this and want to donate lots of money to the Atlanta Film Festival so they can have better selections, I highly encourage you to do so. Actually, you know, it's funny. The Atlanta Jewish Film Festival starts in 2 days, and they're going to have, I think... Well, first off, they have Big Bad Wolves, which Tarantino was like, this is the best film of 2013. So I got to see that. And then they have Israel's submission for the Best Picture winner. They have Bethlehem. And that's something I caught at TIFF. And that won all of basically Israel's equivalent of the Oscars. That was a huge winner there. I saw it at TIFF and I'm like, really? This is your movie? Okay, Israel. Well, far be it for me to judge, but I thought that film was... I judged it as mediocre. But yes, film festivals, they're variety, they're good to go to, they're great for advocacy, but I feel like when you're at the majors, you have to be a bit more honest.
Sure.
And that's not to say you're being dishonest at smaller ones, but you're just being more of a champion, and you don't want to tear certain movies down. But the size of the festival dictates the... sort of the level of professionalism, I guess. It's hard to describe. I can't find... Professionalism isn't the right word, but I would say...
Not to say your professionalism wavers from festival to festival.
It doesn't waver. The harshness of your critiques.
Yeah.
I would say that's it. The more discerning you are... Because, like, if I'm at a smaller festival, I see a true indie, what I'm going to do is talk up its positives and really focus on that. And if I'm talking with the filmmaker directly, I'll tell them, you know, this really worked for me, this didn't, but if I were to write a review of it, I wouldn't, you know, just tear it apart. Or if I didn't like it, I just wouldn't write about it, period.
Which reminds me that one of my favorite experiences from this past Sundance was getting to go see the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself in a press screening. So it was a theater full of press, full of film critics, full of entertainment journalists. So that was a lot of fun because it was kind of a communal atmosphere and kind of taking that film in, which it's a good film. It's a sad film because, you know, obviously Steve James, director of Hoop Dreams, started this documentary before he knew that Roger Ebert's illness was terminal in the short term. So it was sad, but it's a good film, and it was interesting to watch with a bunch of other film critics.
Yeah, and that, I will say this, there is a good variety at these festivals. You don't have to be like Slit Your Wrist Festival, where it's just like misery nonstop. There were some sad films, especially, I mean, in the doc category, you had, you had Aaron Schwartz, which was a sad film in its own way. And then It's an angry film.
Maddening film. It's sad, yes. But it's very, it's
more. Let me put it this way. It doesn't create the fun, uplifting feeling of the battered bastards of baseball. It is not that. That was a fun documentary, though. That was a really good one. And I don't
that's
know.
I made it this year. I made it a point to see more documentaries at Sundance, because if you look at the best documentary nominees for each year's Oscars, they're almost always filled with movies that premiered or played at Sundance that year. Sundance just has a reputation for picking excellent docs. So I'm hoping some of these will pop up on other people's radar. I mean, last year we had 20 Feet from Stardom. Stories We Tell was there. Active Killing was not there.
I think, was Cutie and the Boxer there? Cutie and the Boxer was there. I remember that. Yeah, Cutie and the Boxer was at Sundance last year. Yeah. I don't know if maybe Dirty Wars was there. I'm thinking of this year's nominees.
Yeah,
I think The Square was there last year.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right there. If you're a documentary fiend, you can definitely find some good stuff at Sundance, as opposed to TIFF, which I mean, it has good docs, but although it's, I will say that, well, you know what, I'm actually gonna take that back, because The Act of Killing premiered at TIFF, and so did Stories We Tell, so I'm gonna take that one back. But you're right, I would say in terms of as many, you're right, it's not their forte, because I think Sundance is willing to take more chances on documentaries. The thing about TIFF is that it gets crowded with stuff that could be in the awards race. It's the prestige films, and that fact that it gets crowded with that pushes other stuff out. So that's the trade-off there. Not that and for anyone that's confused, we're not complaining about TIFF. We're not like, boo TIFF. We were in line, we were scrapping to get into Gravity. We were not fucking around on that. Same with 12 Years a Slave. Like, we wanted into those films badly.
Sure.
It's just, it's not as...
They're different film festivals, and I like...
They're absolutely different festivals. They're still prestigious. Both are prestigious in their own way. That's sort of what we're getting to here. I would say this year's Sundance, of the 4 years I've been going, I would rate this one the least for the reasons I've named. It wasn't a bad year. I'm not going to be like, fuck you, Sundance, because when I tell people I go, that I'm going, they're like, ooh, can you pack me in your suitcase? And I'm like, no, that's illegal and you die. But they want to come, is the larger point. And so people who don't go, they want to go, I think, they would have a good time. It has, like I said, a great atmosphere. If you go, you should go to Danzanas. Is that the name of the pizza place?
Davanzas.
We are horribly plugging this place. But it's so... Their pizza is amazing. They are really good. And it's so fucking crowded. That's how much people love this place. Also, if you go to the Yarrow, they have the Yarrow Hotel has an amazing chicken Caesar salad. Everything else they'll get wrong. They will get your order wrong completely. But if they can't, they don't mess up the chicken Caesar salad, so go for that. It's fun, though. Like, we go to, like, the same... It just has that flavor to it. Like, when I go to Toronto, there's, like, that burrito place, Ziteca, which is good. But when I go to Sundance, the Press Theater has frozen Bunch of Crunch, which is delicious. Like, it's just that... It has just more flavor to it. That's why I like Sundance. But this year was a little underwhelming for the reasons I named. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. But obviously I would be bummed to miss it, you know, to be on the outside of it. So those are my thoughts on Sundance this year. Adam, any closing thoughts before we move on to recommendations?
I don't think so. I'm interested to see, one of the other fun things about Sundance is sitting there, seeing a movie that you really like and then going, how the hell are they going to market this? Or like, how is this going to do well in it? And I talked with a couple other people at the festival about how they haven't really had a big commercial hit in the past few years. Like, I mean, Fruitvale Station was not a box office bonanza, neither was Beasts of the Southern Wild. I think the last big kind of crossover hit, I would say, would be 500 Days of Summer, that a movie that premiered at Sundance and then kind of hit the general public well. So you see these movies, you really like these movies, and then you kind of get sad thinking that, you know, they might be lost in the shuffle. But again, we live in a different box office climate now with VOD and everything, so I hope there's room for movies like The Voices or The Guest on VOD. I think if they release The Guest at Halloween, I think it has a good shot at possibly crossing over because of the Downton Abbey fans interested to see Dan Stevens play a psychopath.
It's what I want to see. I think that's an easy sell. Yes. Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey as a psychopath.
Exactly.
I want to see that. But I will say, yeah, as the films themselves, they aren't big hits, but it's a great launching pad. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you could define it as. It's a launching pad for actors and directors who really start getting attention, because I think that even though Fruitvale wasn't a big hit, everyone was talking about Michael B. Jordan.
And Ryan Coogler.
And that really helped them out. So, yeah, I would agree. That no big hits, but I think as a good launch pad. Okay, let's move on to recommendations. Adam, what do you got?
I am recommending a film that was the opening night film of the 2008 Sundance Film Festival, and it is In Bruges, Martin McDonagh's black comedy. I did not know that this played at Sundance until I went kind of searching online to see kind of what other previous films had played there. If you're not familiar with In Bruges, it's really the movie that kind of relaunched Colin Farrell's career after Hollywood tried to make him into an A-list, you know, movie star, and that kind of didn't go well, and he had some personal problems as well. But In Bruges is the movie that kind of proved that, you know, this guy can really act, and it's a great two-hander between Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson. Farrell plays a rookie hitman who's grieving over he's wracked with guilt over the fact that he accidentally killed a young boy, and so he's kind of holed up with his partner, played by Brendan Gleeson, and they're kind of trying to figure out what to do while they're in the city of Bruges, and Ralph Fiennes is their gangster boss and kind of comes to kind of set things straight. But it's a really funny, really darkly funny movie. It's been one of my favorites for years. Martin McDonagh went on to next direct Seven Psychopaths, which I wasn't a huge fan of. I know other people were. I still think In Bruges is the tops. But if you haven't seen In Bruges, I highly suggest you seek it out. It's funny, it's sweet, it's weird and different, and Colin Farrell's great in it.
Okay, cool. I'm going to recommend Paul Thomas Anderson's Hard Eight. When we were at Sundance this year, they played a bumper, because this was Sundance's 30th anniversary. So what the bumper was that played in front of all the films was a collection of some of the biggest highlights from the past 30 years. And so even watching it was kind of neat, because you're just like, man, what must it have been like to be at Sundance when Reservoir Dogs premiered? Like, that must have been crazy. Or even like more recent stuff like Winter's Bone. It's like, wow, what must it have been like to see Jennifer Lawrence in her breakthrough role? It's things like that. And one of the films listed was Hard Eight, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's feature directing debut. And it's so good. It is this neo-noir crime film that stars Philip Baker Hall, who plays normally, he's a character actor and he is almost in supporting roles. But this time he gets to be the lead. He's sort of this old gambler who encounters this sort of struggling guy played by John C. Reilly. And John C. Reilly's character needs $300 for his mother's funeral. And so Hall's character, whose name's Sidney, which is the original title of the film, Sidney takes Reilly's character under his wing, helps him sort of get started, and then we jump forward 2 years later where Reilly's character is sort of more, you know, he's sort of gone in the groove of it. He's still friends with Sidney, but he's also sort of fallen for this prostitute played by Gwyneth Paltrow. And Reilly's character and Paltrow's character, they get into this sort of deep trouble that they have to call on Sidney to help them out, and this draws him past to his own secrets that threaten to come out. And it's just a great hard-boiled film with fantastic performances. And again, as a debut feature, it's something where it's like, wow, this Paul Thomas Anderson kid is going places. And it's again, so to see that at Sundance must have been such a thrill, but it holds up so well in his filmography. And I think it's something that gets a little overshadowed because a film like that's going to get a little overshadowed when you've done Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and There Will Be Blood. A little film like Heart 8 gets a little push, but it's great. It doesn't have... We see some films here that have their issues. They're like, they have their growing pains, and you see like, okay, this could be better, and I expect great things. So just this year, Damien Chazelle, I don't think Whiplash is an amazing film, but it shows so much potential, and I'll be really interested to see what he does next. Heart 8 is like, you have hit the ground running, and I am going, you, what you do next is going to blow people's minds, and what he did next was Boogie Nights. So I would definitely recommend Heart 8. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
Okay, next week we will be sort of playing it by ear, because the thing is we have that awkward moment, which is could be good. I'm hoping it's good.
It's a good cast. I really
it's
hope it's
good.
It's
a good cast, but like we were talking about this at Sunday. It's like, boy, I hope this isn't misogynistic. Like, I hope it's just a good rom-com, but we'll see. And then there's Labor Day, which is just, when we're talking about these festivals and breakout films, Labor Day got such a good response at TIFF, and it died. That is such a weird one.
Didn't die. Paramount buried it. That one's on Paramount. I don't know what
I mean,
there.
Things die when they get buried alive, Adam, sure. Is what I'm saying. That'll be interesting. It's opening wide. I have no idea how it's going to do at the box office. I'm sure Jason Reitman is sitting there with his fingers crossed. He's like, just do better than I, Frankenstein. Just do better than I, Frankenstein. Just do better than I, Frankenstein. Okay, but yes. And then the following week, we've got some fun stuff with Lego Movie Monuments Men. And I actually have high hopes for Vampire Academy. I think that could be a nice surprise.
It doesn't look bad. I think everyone was surprised, but go and look at the second trailer that was released. It was like, oh, all right. And I mean, it's the same writer as Heathers, same director as Mean Girls.
Yeah, there could be some good stuff in there. But yeah. We'll see. But that's 2 weeks away.
Sure.
We'll be back with you next week. So thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks, guys.